Hey, Chit Chat listeners, options trading is live on public.com. And if you activate by March 31st, you can earn a rebate of 18 cents on every contract traded. Simply sign up at public.com and activate options to get a lifetime rebate. You don't even have to start trading right away. Meanwhile, if you want to switch from your current brokerage, Public will reward you with up to $10,000. It only takes a few minutes to kickstart your transfer with a simple online process. Join the thousands of traders earning a rebate of 18 cents on every options contract traded, but hurry, you have to activate by March 31st only at public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. Must activate options account by March 31st for revenue share. Options are not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures are in the podcast description. U.S. members only.
Welcome to Chit Chat Stocks. On this show, hosts Ryan Henderson and Brett Schaefer analyze businesses and riff on the world of investing. As a quick reminder, Chit Chat Stocks is a CCM Media Group podcast. Anything discussed on Chit Chat Stocks by Ryan, Brett, or any other podcast guest is not formal advice or recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
Welcome in, everyone. This is Chit Chat Stocks. My name is Brett Schaefer, and as always, joined by Ryan Henderson, we are continuing our series of looking at some of the most famous investors in the world, some of the ones that have had the top performance over the long term, and seeing what we could learn. We've covered Ray Dalio in the past. We've covered Norbert Liu. And for our third one, we are talking about, as the title says here, what may be the best investor in Britain. Question mark, right? As the title is, we're trying to tease some people in here. Hopefully we have some, you know, nice UK audience joining us today. But the man is Terry Smith, running Fund Smith, and has done quite well since launching in 2010. So we're going to be studying that today. And Ryan, as we want to get right into it, no small talk as we try to do on this episode. What is one quality any investor can take from Terry Smith and Fund Smith strategy?
There's a couple, but I would say probably buy right and sit tight is kind of the overarching theme that I've taken away from here. And then maybe one that's a little more unique, because I feel like everyone says that. The best investments you might already own. And he's kind of shown that time and time again with where he's really excelled at buying stuff he already had positions in, and just he knew the business well and he saw an opportunity within his portfolio and he added to it. So we're going to talk through that a little bit here, but really I would say he's done an exception. These are great businesses hiding in plain sight for the most part. We're going to talk through a lot of that portfolio, but it's nothing too crazy on the investment side. There's nothing that really stood out here in terms of the portfolio that was like, oh, I've never heard of that business. They're pretty large companies, and he's just done a really good job buying them at the right time. So buy right and sit tight would maybe be my overarching theme.
Okay, if I want to add in here, one note, as you mentioned, you know, nothing crazy from his strategy. It's something that any investor can replicate as long as they have access to all the markets where he's buying these stocks. But I'm sure most of them are in, you know, well-developed markets. And I'd say my takeaway from studying his writings, as we did before recording this episode, is, and this comes up time and time again for me, and I think is a tip I would go for anyone starting out, is don't over diversify. Now they'll hold 20 stocks in their portfolio, and obviously it's detrimental or extremely risky to own like one or three stocks in your portfolio, but you see a ton of investors out there that might own 50, 60, 70 stocks, all fairly equally weighted. And I think that's just a recipe for higher stress, confusion, and basically to hug the index. And I think that's a big lesson we're going to try to go through here in this episode as well. Before we get started, a few housekeeping items. We are studying, you know, some of the famous investors out there, trying to learn from them, from reading their writings. And any listeners who have one that you want us to cover, let us know. Send us an email, send us a Twitter DM. We'll probably look into it. We're going to try to do maybe one per month maybe a little less of a frequency there, maybe 10 per year, kind of TBD on what we go with our schedule. And for anyone that's looking for our stock analysis episodes, we're still doing those, but again, just on a little bit of a slower cadence. We've had a Nelnet episode out recently, a coupon one, Hims and Hers. Ryan's coming out with one on home builders coming up soon. Should be quite fun. We're going to add those to the mix as well. If you enjoy these episodes, I would say give us a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple. That is the best way to help us grow, help Chit Chat Stocks grow, and make sure we can keep doing this. All right, let's get into the episode. Ryan, who is Terry Smith? And let's give some background here. And I will say this is perhaps one of the most British people I have ever met, or not met, listened to and read his writings.
Yeah, he's a bit peculiar. And we'll talk about this here in a second, maybe a tad bit smug, or maybe I'd say confident is the better word, and we'll get into why that is. And that's not saying, you know, Brett mentioned that he's a very British guy. That's not, these are two separate tangents. He's a bit of a confident guy, and he's also seems very British. Those are not two in the same. But Terry Smith, some background here. He was born in England in 1953. He attended Stratford Grammar School and went on to study history at University College Cardiff, where he graduated in 1974. So bit of an unorthodox background just in terms of financial career. There was nothing pointing to him getting interested in investing. He also, this will maybe come up again, but he had a bit of a boxing background. So he was a boxer when he was a kid. Kind of random, not really that important, but I'll explain why it's kind of funny when we get into other stuff that happened later in his career. But after he graduated, he rejected an offer for a research fellowship and decided he wanted to pursue a career in business. So he joined Barclays Bank. Not sure what the motivation was here. I assume it's financial motivation. It seems to be the main reason. Maybe he had some curiosity around investing at the time, but it just seems like he wanted to pursue a career in business. So that's what he did. And he was at Barclays for a little over 10 years. And during that time, he also became an associate of the Chartered Institute of Bankers. I had to look up what this was. And to be honest, there are a lot of British institutions that I didn't really understand from his background that I had to go back and kind of research over and over. The Chartered Institute of Bankers is a global professional education body for bankers based in the UK. It actually seemed kind of like a group slash, not cults, but it's an organization where you get really good at studying banks and understanding banks. And that was part of his education as well as working at the bank. So during that time, that 10 years where he's at Barclays, he really seemed to get a pretty strong grasp of banking in general. And he also picked up an interest in investing during that same time period. He switched apartments a couple times in Barclays. So he was the leader of one branch at one point, and he ended up switching to the finance department of of Barclays. So anyways, basically that was his informal education of the financial realm, and particularly banks as a sector. And so in 1984, that's 10 years after he was at Barclays, actually 11, he joined a stock brokerage firm and was a broker, I believe, for 6 years. And during that time, he was considered the top-rated banking analyst in London. Ironically, with all that banking expertise, he ended up hating banks as investments, it seems like. And he actually has this kind of funny quote. He says, "Having spent the first decade of my career working in a bank and then becoming a top-rated bank analyst, I find that people often express surprise that I never invest in bank shares. But I think it is precisely because I understand banks that I never invest in their shares. Why? Firstly, I never invest in anything that requires leverage to make an adequate return. Banks have a very small amount of equity to support their balance sheet." He goes on about the potential downsides to investing in banking. And he really, we've talked about margin of safety on this show before. there's margin of safety on the valuation side, and then there's margin of safety, I think, on the business side. And in terms of the business operations, banking, there isn't always that big of a margin of safety, because there's always the risk of deposits kind of going out the door quickly. So yeah, chime in.
I would say yes. One of his, I'd say maybe his number one tenet is margin of safety from a business perspective. And then the other thing I would say here is, if you read his writings, like any other quality investor, he likes to quote Buffett. You know, that's nothing out of the ordinary there. But I would love to hear a conversation between Buffett and Smith around bank stocks, because as a lot of people that follow Buffett knows, he loves the sector. So someone, you know, I just think it would be interesting to hear their differing opinions, because clearly Buffett sees attractiveness in banks, and maybe this is just an American thing versus a United Kingdom thing, who knows? And then Smith basically swore him off and has never invested.
Yeah. And this is part of one of the, issues with us studying a UK-based investor is we don't know all the rules and regulations around the banking sector in the UK and the nuances and differences between that and the US, because, you know, the US might have more of a federal backstop, and maybe there, some of these banks can, there's a little bit more of margin of safety for the big banks because the government and the banks are so involved or intertwined. Anyways, let's keep going with his career. I found this next part pretty interesting. In 1989-1990 timeframe, he joined UBS as the head of UK company research. However, in 1992, he was fired because he wrote an analyst circular called Accounting for Growth that dug into basically the there were a couple of high profile bankruptcies around that time, and the companies were reporting healthy profits, but there was really misleading accounting and the cash flow looked pretty bad. And he basically wrote this post about how some of these companies were intentionally misleading shareholders with their accounting practices. And some of them were like companies that were still operating at the time. And it was really well received. And a lot of the other analysts, people that read the article, were like, you should publish this as a book. And so he said he was going to do it, decided to publish it as a book. A lot of those businesses that were included for having quote unquote intentionally misleading accounting were very frustrated. And I think they were either friends of people at UBS, higher ups, maybe even clients potentially in some way. They said, you know, let's not get this book published. And UBS asked him, hey, let's not publish this book or we're going to have to suspend you. He said, I'm publishing the book. And so they fired him. That's kind of an example of when we started to see, maybe that's good on his morals or whatever, you know, like good for him sticking to his guns, but that confidence and that kind of cojones is maybe the right word, that he was willing to say the truth despite any reparations or problems that could arise from it. So he lost his job, and we'll talk more about what happens after he lost his job. But as I'm looking into Smith's career, that was not the only colorful thing that happened in his past. So another example is Terry Smith was, this was actually prior to the book debacle. It was around the 80s. After he joined that brokerage firm, the firm was called BZW. The first week he wrote a sell suggestion on Barclays. The brokerage firm was owned by Barclays. It was a subsidiary of Barclays. So he wrote a sell suggestion on his own company after being hired by them a week after. So that's another example of maybe, I don't want to say the arrogance, because it might be the opposite. It might just be the fact that he's willing to say the truth no matter what.
I think the word you're looking for here is provocative. He's not afraid to say things that might stir the pot. And for another example, later in his career, he wrote time and time again about the struggles of IBM and how we thought it was a big mistake for Buffett to invest in them, which it ended up being. But at the time, you know, going against Buffett, going against IBM, probably sounded out of the ordinary. And there's probably a lot of people at IBM and some of these investment banks, you know, given their earnings per share manipulations and stuff like that, that didn't want those type of things written. But now his track record is so good that I think people look at him in a different light of like, okay, now you're not the plucky, confident, cocky younger guy. You're more experienced and you might still have this provocative nature, but we're going to respect you a lot more.
Yeah, he's very outspoken and feisty, provocative, all that. One last story before we get to the rest of his career. Apparently, and this was, I couldn't really find that many details on this story, but apparently at a black tie client dinner, there was a client who was irritating him and he reportedly headbutted the client. So kind of going back to those old boxing roots, you know, a feisty guy.
Yeah, the European. So he's like the soccer player, right? Zinedine Zidane, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, that is accurate. Anyway, so he's had some kind of controversial moments in his career. He's always been outspoken, very provocative, and likes to tell things how he sees it. But I would say after those kind of big debacles, it kind of got cleaned up after that. There doesn't seem, he's still outspoken, but it just not as much controversy. So in 1992, he joined a brokerage firm called Colin Stewart that went on to have a lot of success. It was a small brokerage at the time, but it grew. They acquired some companies. They went public, I believe. And he kind of worked his way up there and became the CEO. And he was the CEO there for quite a while and actually started the Fundsmith, the fund management company, in 2010. He did not resign as CEO or step down until 2014. So for the first 4 years that he was running Fundsmith, he was also the CEO of this brokerage firm. But in 2014, he did resign, step down, and he began focusing solely on Fundsmith. That brings it to today. He has, well, we're going to talk about this in a second, outperformed the market. He's done a good job running this fund management company. He's accumulated a lot of assets in the process and or a lot of money from investors in the process, and in general done a pretty good job buying high quality businesses and holding on to them. So with that said, let's get more into it. What is Fundsmith and what have the returns actually looked like? Because there's a little bit of controversy here. I've seen people say the performance isn't that good. Why don't we put the numbers out there and talk about how well he's actually done?
Yeah. And for their performance numbers, I am using what they give us. And I know sometimes people will convert currencies and stuff like that since they're based in the United Kingdom. So just fair warning on some of the stuff, we did convert to US dollars for like AUM, and that might change just based on the prevailing exchange rate. But some of the other stuff, it could change if you're not using the exchange, you know, and stuff like that, constant currency. So just know if you run your own calculations, it might be slightly different, but I think all of this is directionally correct. So Fundsmith was founded on November 1st, 2010. So we're closing in on 15 years here shortly. Currently has $44.5 billion in USD in AUM total, and then $32 billion, I think, in the flagship equity fund. I will admit, fund websites always confuse me, especially when there are multiple strategies. So apologies if anything is slightly off, but you know, listeners should just know, I think the takeaway is that they are running one of the largest active funds in the world right now. Okay. So if we look at performance, since November 1st, 2010 to the end of February 2024, Fundsmith returns net of fees are 596.3%. Or 15.7% annualized. So essentially 16% annualized returns. If we compare that to relative benchmarks from the same date, we have 392% for the S&P 500 ETF owners. I just did this, the SPY. 253.7% for the MSCI World Index. And then 746.7% total return for the NASDAQ 100. And I just used QQQ there. So again, these are all total return levels. And I think it's possible that their returns are in UK, you know, British pounds, and some of these other returns are in US dollars. So part of that, I don't know, the exchange rates could help them or hurt them a little bit there. But over time, I don't think that's going to be too crazy. It's not like it's the Argentinian or Turkish lira, you know. And if we look at performance, yeah, they've slightly underperformed QQQ, I think we can forgive them for that, especially as we sit here recording in March of 2024. They've put up consistent results, and they've had, you know, on top of the outperformance, they've had positive returns every year except 2022, all without shorting or hedging, which I think is quite impressive, where it's, people say that volatility can be your friend, but it's a lot of times it can be your foe psychologically. And if you have lower volatility stocks in your portfolio, I think, yes, it might be the same total return as some other stocks. And at the end of the day, you would, you know, in say some sort of back test, have maybe even slightly worse returns. But you never know how you're going to act in high stress environments. And I think with the, what do you call it? Like, it eliminates that risk from occurring. So you're eliminating that even personally. Like, we all can act irrationally in times of stress in the markets. And I think Fundsmith try to eliminate that. And, you know, they've had only one down year investing in some of these, which I think is quite interesting. And they're still, you know, outperforming the indices. And as they talk about, they're not index huggers, which I think is impressive as well. Anything there, Ryan, before we go to the strategy?
No, I will say, I think he talks a little bit too much about his Sortino ratio and like bragging about the lack of volatility. Maybe it's just me being a young investor, but I don't think it's that big of a deal that you are really low volatility. Maybe if he's got a lot of older clients, it makes sense because they might have to access some of the capital on a regular basis. So, and my guess is that that is the case because he is an older gentleman himself. I think he's 70 years old now. And I would not be surprised if a lot of his big investors are people that he's met over the years that are around his age. So maybe they care a lot about it.
Isn't that nice that he started this after the age of 50? That gives you know, for all the listeners out there as well as ourselves, there's still time out there.
Yeah, you know, plenty of time.
30 years from now, we could start something up again. All right, let's hit the strategy. I think you have your notes here first, Ryan. What is the Fundsmith strategy? And I think as a little tease for investors, as we go kind of into the meat here, you know, as we look at it, there's nothing here an individual investor can't replicate.
No. It was kind of just very boilerplate stuff. I mean, he's saying a lot of the right things. So in the most recent annual letter, he said, "We continue to apply a simple three-step investment strategy. Buy good companies, don't overpay, do nothing." That is the long-term investor's MO. That is what they always are trying to do. And as we look at a lot of his holdings, that actually seems to be the strategy that they've implemented. Most of his largest holdings today is owned for several years. And he has typically kept them pretty consistent, continue to buy more shares. Now, it obviously depends kind of for him how the flows of money coming in and out of the fund go, because he'll have to sell shares or whatever. But in terms of portfolio allocation, he tends to actually raise the allocation when those companies consistently perform. And hopefully as the multiple comes down a bit. So here's a good example. They increased, I want to make sure I get the exact right number here. Let's pull it up. Meta, and he talked about this in the most recent shareholder letter. So he increased his Meta allocation from 3% to 7.5% over the last year, and most of that happened in kind of Q1, Q2. He really bought a ton of Meta shares when at the end of 2022, Q4 2022. So I believe that's kind of around when all the CapEx related with Reality Labs was weighing on the stock price. And so if you overlay the stock price on this chart, he did a really good job buying something that he owned for a long time and just did it at the right price. Anyways, that just goes to say he buys the good companies, he waits. And then I think the secret sauce here for him and Fundsmith in general is their portfolio management skills. Being able to buy the companies and be patient with companies they already own. Because you look at the holdings, there's nothing unique about the strategy. I mean, maybe it's unique in practice, but in in terms of what people try to do, aim to do with their portfolios, buy good companies, do it at a decent price, and do nothing is kind of what everyone wants to be doing. So there's nothing that unique there. It's really just the fact that they're very patient and they are opportunistic with the companies that they already own.
I agree. Yeah. The one thing that I would even note, and I think they would agree with this if we talk with them, is they'd probably give them mea culpa. I think it's mea culpa or mea culpa. Because in their earlier letters, they talked about Domino's being one of their top performers and it did quite well. You know, they, it was one of their initial holdings and it outperformed. But if we look today, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan, I did not see it in the portfolio. And I don't think they timed the top. And if we look at Domino's total return, it's 1,500% since they started the fund. So it's, like, I would say that their one mistake was that they would admit that they even need to improve on this strategy, where in the past, their mistakes still, as someone who tries to purposely water the flowers, trim the weeds, right? They would say they need to do that even more. And I think it just goes to show that selling on valuation for a high quality business, you better be right about how overpriced it is.
Just tough. Here's a quote from their most recent annual meeting with, I think it happened either today or yesterday.
Yeah, really soon. Yeah.
As of this recording, he says, and some of this is like UK slang, so I don't always, it doesn't always make sense to me the way it's said, but he says, "You make money with old friends. If you've got something big like Microsoft that you get right, the likelihood is it's going to continue to be right. I'm not a gardener, but I'm told that what you're supposed to do is water the flowers and pull up the weeds. An awful lot of people do it the other way around. They sell the things that worked and hang on to the things which are not working in the hope they'll come right. Our strategy, and in my view, the correct way to do it, is the opposite of that, to run our big winners." It feels like that's been the blueprint for their success. Do you want to dig into some of the stuff they're looking – more specifically, they lay out a couple of bullet points, what they're looking for in potential investments.
Yeah. And I think for any new listeners, they can look at these criteria that they have and they say, okay, well, look for good companies, don't overpay, do nothing. And the last two are easy to understand. With the valuation, you go, okay, don't overpay for something that's lower growth, might be high quality business, but is trading at 50 times earnings, right? You don't want to pay for that. Do nothing, also easy. Buy and hold. Don't be a super active trader. But what is a good company? And to them, they have a few criteria, some of which are quite popular, but I think some of which might be underrated. And I'm going to go through each and we can kind of look at maybe some examples of these in action. What do they actually mean by this? And any examples from, you know, outside or inside the Fundsmith portfolio. So the first one they have is high quality businesses that can sustain a high return on operating capital employed. Now, this one just means it's their version of return on invested capital. They use the ROCE, which I think they care a lot about equity capital. The one thing, and look, this makes sense because you want someone that at the end of the day, the money that the business invests, you want it to be a good return. The one thing I think I would be concerned about is the definition of invested capital. And that's where I always come back to with these things, where I think anchoring to a specific number, where if you gave someone some company that has a lot of intangibles or something like that, a 60% ROIC, it actually might not be that high versus someone who has an overstated, book value.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I think the concept there makes sense. And I guess the ones that are less intangible make a lot of sense from a, like, you can really quantify it much easier. So anything from their portfolio that you see as someone that just earns high returns on, you know, high returns on invested capital.
Yeah, that makes sense. What were some of the, I think I might be skipping ahead here, but what were some of the companies in the portfolio that surprised you?
Oh, okay. One that surprised me was Nike, just because he seems to worry about the China risk a lot, and he worries about consumer goods that are trading at an expensive multiple, and maybe Nike's come down a bit, I'm not sure, or maybe they bought it at a different multiple, right?
Yeah.
But it's lower growth, you know, and they don't seem to have much exposure to apparel. So that surprised me a bit, especially because it was a decently large position and something like Apple was a smaller position for them. I thought what was interesting is, relative to today, is that they talked about buying Apple, starting a little starter position in, what would it have been, like late 2022, early 2023. And then he was kind of complaining in a joking manner where he said, we foresaw that they'd have five bad quarters in a row. And then they had these five bad quarters in a row and the stock's up by 50%. So what I thought was interesting was that, one, okay, like some of these Magnificent Seven stocks might be a bit, and not even just Magnificent Seven stocks, but large cap growth, mega cap companies, the larger end of the market might be a bit overextended at the moment. But besides that, it's interesting that they took a starter position with almost the prediction that the stock would keep falling. If you get what I mean. I thought that was an interesting way to go about it.
Before we move on, we want to talk about our friends at FinChat.io. FinChat.io is the complete stock research platform for fundamental investors. Beyond having all the standard financial data for companies around the globe, they also have company-specific segments and KPIs on over 1,500 stocks. So if you want to see Amazon's AWS revenue over the last 10 years, or you want to track Match Group's paying users, maybe you're curious how many stores Sprouts Farmers Market added last quarter, FinChat tracks all those KPIs and literally 500,000 more. We know that if you're a fundamental investor, you probably track this stuff yourself, but this saves so much time and it has all the data you already need. If you aren't sure where to go, you can also simply ask FinChat. That is their conversational AI powered by FinChat's proprietary data. So that'll save you tons and tons of time researching. They've got stock screening tool. They've got fundamental charting that is best in class in terms of design. I use FinChat every day. I absolutely love the platform. Brett does as well. We both use it as our primary dashboard and the place where we do all our research. So if you want to get 25% off any paid plan, use our link, finchat.io/chitchat. That is finchat.io/chitchat. The link will also be in our show notes.
That is interesting. I'm looking at the Nike one right now. They initiated this position in first quarter of 2020. So COVID.
Not bad there.
I don't know what the chart looks like, but I would guess it was a pretty good time to buy. Apple, yeah, that is interesting that they're willing to buy a starting position knowing there's trouble ahead, which, I mean, I guess kudos to them, because if you're going to do it, it better be a starter position. And it actually ended up working out for them in terms of the stock price, and the forecast ended up being right, which I think is funny. For me, the one that I find kind of surprising is McCormick. Yeah, I'm looking at the rest of these businesses and they all make sense to me. There's a lot of economies of scale and I've just never really understood the McCormick thesis. It doesn't feel like, aside from acquiring more and more companies in the space, I don't see how it's a better value add to customer. Like, I don't think they have that much pricing power. It's maybe the way to say it. And you look
I think competitively, no, but like spices probably do, just because if some stuff is like $4 or $5, it's not that big of a chunk out of your grocery bill and you're not going to notice it.
Sure. If I see two spices near each other, I don't really care that much about the brand.
That's true. Yeah.
I'll probably go for the lower priced one. So that one kind of surprised me. In general, another anecdote I thought was funny is I think this was in the 2010, 2011 letter. They mentioned that the average year of founding of the companies in their portfolio was like, it was in the 1800s. So he is buying very old businesses that have been around for a long time, proven their durability, you know, he's not trying to find hidden gems or small caps that no one else or other people are overlooking. It's really kind of a very simple equity strategy, and he's not doing new work. He's not finding quality where no one else has found it. A lot of these are companies where everyone knows it's a good business. He's just buying them at the right time and having a long-term horizon.
Okay, let's go through the next bullet point. Businesses whose advantages are difficult to replicate. I'm actually going to skip this one because everyone talks about competitive advantages. I think that's just their note for that as well. We've talked ad nauseum on the show. People around the world, Buffett, everyone, you know, talks about these. And I think that's nothing specific to them. They're looking for these type of businesses as well. But I think these other bullet points are more specific, kind of on the edges here, that can help weed out potentially bad investments. So the third one they have are businesses which do not require significant leverage to generate returns. So essentially, they can run, they can grow, they can generate a lot of cash, they can reinvest without needing to take on a bunch of debt. What do you think about this one, Ryan?
Sorry, I was on mute there. I'm a little more willing to accept leverage. I like the way this is worded, though, because it's not he won't take companies with leverage. It's he won't take companies that require leverage to generate significant returns. So that doesn't mean the companies in his portfolio won't have some debt on them. It's just that if you really need debt to juice returns, like you need with banks, I mean, you really, really do in those cases. I appreciate that because it's just a higher risk strategy running any company that way. So I like it. Don't take that as they are completely averse to debt. It's well worded.
Yeah. And one thing within here that I think relates, it's not in these bullet points, but it's something they talk a lot about, which is a part of their criteria for a high quality business, is high cash flow conversion, where they, I think in 2023 it was a bit lower, but they expected just from timing issues to rebound to 100% or higher, where you're converting 100% or higher of your net profits to the actual cash flow that can be returned to shareholders or maybe reinvested. While the average company in the, you know, that's publicly traded is at maybe 80%. And that's a huge difference that I think not many investors talk about. So prioritizing really strong cash flow conversion, it's probably the same as, you know, not needing to take on leverage to reinvest for growth because you have that cash available and you have a lot of flexibility. But I think that's something any investor who's trying to improve can learn from. Now let's go to the fourth one here. And this is one that is very popular and for good reason among a lot of quality investors out there. And it is businesses with a high degree of certainty of growth from reinvestment of their cash flows at high rates of return. This is a fancy way of saying long reinvestment runway at their current high return on invested capital. Thoughts here, Ryan, and any that pop out on the list here? I would say they have Microsoft as their top holding, and a clear one is the cloud business, right? Where you can invest. There's just a giant runway here, and you know it's got the moat and long or good returns on invested capital.
Yeah, no, honestly, a lot of these bullet points, I've said it before, they're not reinventing the wheel. This is not new stuff. It seems like very boilerplate standard principles for what to look for in a good investment. We've talked about this a ton on the show, especially when we studied NVR and Norbert Liu. It's not enough to just have high ROIC. You want to have the room for IC in ROIC matters. How much can they continue to plow capital into the business and obviously generate similar rates of return on that invested capital over time? Because if they're just continuing to invest capital, but it's at lower and lower rates, that's not good either. You could pretty much, I feel like you could pick out every company in their portfolio. You could probably find a way to use the bullet points for. It feels kind of too general for me, some of these.
Yeah, that's true. But maybe this next one is more specific, where I think a lot of retail investors, ourselves maybe included, could be, you know, it could be helpful to maybe think about it more. And this fifth one, which the last one is valuation, so this is really the last one, and it is businesses that are resilient to change, particularly technological innovation. And if we look at a lot of their consumer goods companies, I think that plays out here, where if you're in a business that might look attractive, good customer value proposition, arguably high competitive advantage, but it's in an industry that has been continuously disrupted, I would say, and yes, Apple's probably the exception here, computing hardware is one that probably sits there. It's been so innovative, so disruptive. There's been so many new paradigms that, yeah, or maybe even chip making.
Yeah, let's go through. This is maybe a good chance to go through his holdings because it, and I know I'm hopping around here, but a lot of these, they are either multi-product companies where they have, if one thing becomes obsolete, they're not screwed. You know, they can lean on a different part of the business, or there's something that really never goes away. So for example, number one holding is actually Novo Nordisk, but they have a bunch of different bets. Second largest holding, Microsoft, a bunch of different tech products in there that they're not entirely reliant on a single one. Meta Platforms, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. I think there's basically three pillars in there. That might be the, of all the companies in their portfolio, I would say that is maybe the most at risk to technological disruption. Stryker, I think that's like a big tech conglomerate, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's medical device, but I honestly don't know much about it.
IDEX Laboratories, LVMH, L'Oreal, Philip Morris International, Pepsi. These businesses have been around for a long time, more than a century in most cases, and they're just really, really durable. And so I like that. It's kind of the Bezos thing, right? You want to find something where it's not going to change and invest there because
it's something that people are going to want.
Certainty. Yeah.
Yeah. There are a few things out there that you have prediction on that people are still going to want in 10, 20, 30 years, even though a lot of the economy is different. All right. Well, he's had some various articles over the year that I think are quite provocative. And we can go through some of these. This one that was titled "Do Performance Fees Work?" It's obviously a bit of a rhetorical question. I think people know the conclusion there. It was written in September 2010. And I'm not going to read the full quote, but he basically says 2 and 20 is unsupportable, which is the standard fee formula for the hedge fund industry. For anyone that doesn't know, that's basically 2% flat every year and then 20% of any profits generated per year. And he goes on to talk about, as you know, if you invested with Warren Buffett 45 years ago, he's had a compounded return of 20%. If you invested $1,000 when he began running Berkshire in 1965, in 2009, you would have $4.3 million. But if he charged 2 and 20 as Berkshire Hathaway, if it was a hedge fund, you know, in a different structure, then Buffett would take $4 million of that. And then only $300,000 would belong to you, the investor. Now, I think $1,000 to $300,000 is still quite good, right? But he comes to say that performance fees do not work. And essentially, like, these managers are taking, even if they're doing well, taking way more value than they should be of what's fair. And what's interesting, though, is he says performance fees do not work. And he's, you know, he goes and says like 1 in 10 wouldn't really even work over the long term. But he's using Buffett here as an example. And Buffett himself used performance incentives when running his investment firm in the 50s and 60s. So what do you think of this kind of dichotomy? Do you agree with this article or what?
Maybe. I mean, There is no perfect fee structure. I think we experience that in a big way, where performance fees could, yes, theoretically be the best of the worst, where you're only getting paid, it depends on the performance fee, but let's say you're getting paid on market outperformance. That's great, right? As an investor, you are not getting any money taken from you unless you outperform the market. However, one, it depends on the size of the fees, right? If someone's taking 50% of profits or 30% of profits or 20% of profits and 2% fixed, it's going to eat away at returns in a huge way. I don't know what would be better between a 1%, what do they call it? Just management? A 1% management fee. There's like a term that a lot of the ETFs use, but I can't remember what it's called. I don't know what would be better between a 1% management fee and a, call it 1-in-30 structure. Well, I guess probably in that case, it'd be the 1%, but let's say it was like half a percent and 30% of performance fees. I don't know. I don't hate performance fees the way he does, because it's a little bit of downside protection. He's talking about the best case scenario here, where it's like you would have had your returns eaten away if you invested in Berkshire. It's like, okay, true, but at least you wouldn't be paying somebody 1% of your money every year to be putting money in bonds or something like that. So
right. Or just hugging the index. Yeah, exactly. And I think like he has obviously good idea here, where a lot of funds are overcharging stuff. But I think he takes it a little far, where, okay, one, no one's forcing anyone to invest in these things. So, right? It's not like maybe they mislead, and that's probably bad. It definitely is bad if you kind of mislead the investors and don't really show them exactly what is the costs are going to be if you do well. But I think performance fees with a high watermark, as long as they're not really, really low benchmarks or, you know, something like that, can't, by definition, are not going to be bad, because you're not going to have that risk of, okay, 5, 6, 7, 8 good years and then you blow up by taking a ton of risk, because then you can claw that back, I'd say. But like Ryan mentioned, there's so much nuance here, and it's probably a discussion for another episode that's really not that entertaining for a podcast. So let's move on to something more fun. And this one, I think, is probably the most informative for anyone that's a newer listener, and probably some, you know, for any more experienced ones listening, because he probably has done better than you, done better than us. And these are the rules he follows. They seem simple, but here's the article. It's 10 rules for investors. It's from 2013. I think he still follows these today. And I'm going to list them all, and then we can talk about any thoughts and maybe any we disagree with. So let's go through the list. One, if you don't fully understand it, don't invest. Two, don't try to time the market. Three, minimize fees. Four, deal as infrequently as possible. I would say 3 and 4 are actually highly related. Five, don't over diversify. Six, never invest just to avoid tax. Seven, never invest in poor quality companies. Eight, buy shares in a business which can be run by an idiot. Nine, don't engage in, quote, greater fool theory. 10, if you don't like what's happening to your shares, switch off the screen. I'm going to go first and say one I disagree with is never invest in poor quality companies, because if someone can offer you a negative value on a company, right? Like if you're literally paying $10 million for a balance sheet of $100 million, like net cash,
that
can be given back to you, you of course do that. So I think that's one I disagree with, but in general, it's a good rule of thumb, I think, and especially with their strategy with larger mega cap, you know, large and mega cap companies.
Yeah. I like a lot of these. Like you, the never invest in poor quality companies. Obviously, if someone offers you a mediocre business that you know is worth $50 million and they offer it to you for $10 million, you should take that. But I think when you're playing with huge amounts of money like he does, you probably don't. There's probably not enough bad businesses at that size to really invest in.
Not today too, especially because maybe there wasn't like the 60s, right? But today, there's not. And that could reappear, but I'd say probably far-fetched.
Yeah. Looking at the rest of these here, don't over-diversify. I like that.
What's your favorite? Is that your favorite?
Probably. Yeah. Probably. Maybe if you don't fully understand it, don't invest.
Yeah, I think that's one that is probably the most useful. I think if we could get every listener to get that ingrained into their brain.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The only thing I would say is that I always, no matter what, no matter how thorough my research is, I learn more about the company over time after buying it. And part of that is because you know, the future is uncertain and things are going to change. But I feel like I always get a little bit more of an intimate understanding the longer that I own something. And right. So I don't mind buying a starter position here and there if I think it's a pretty good idea, but I don't have like the ultimate grasp on the company. Because the other problem here is if you can acquire an understanding of pretty much any business in the world, if you spend enough time doing it, that doesn't mean it makes it a better investment. So,
yeah.
And I fall into that sunk cost of like, oh, I've done all the research. Now I got to buy a position, when really it's probably not the right thing to do. Sometimes it's as simple as this is a very valuable service, trades at a reasonable price. I'll buy a starter position and over time I'll own it and maybe it becomes an even better investment 5 years down the road.
Yeah, he said at the annual meeting this year that he thinks the best strategy would be to take essentially the one stock that they get most criticized for or complaints from investors in the year prior and make that the only buy that year for the next year. Because that one just crushes the market. So,
and he used Meta as his example, which
makes sense. We were part of that, unfortunately.
I called Meta uninvestable at the absolute bottom.
Yeah, I just say Ryan. You know, right? That might have been one of your worst calls, but you know,
that's okay.
Hey, Buffett bought IBM.
Yeah,
that was a bigger mistake than that. You know, and that was like $10 billion, I bet. What was I gonna say? Oh yeah, on the starter position thing. So for example, like Ryan, your portfolio could easily be 10 stocks could be 90% of it, but you might have a lot of tiny positions in there that are just a way to almost treat it as a watch list.
Yeah.
Let's see, anything else in here before we move on? We talked about Fundsmith today.
Let's go through some of the holdings.
Let's do that.
Let's go through some of the holdings. I'll go through the top 10 here and we can talk about, I don't know, any surprises potentially. So top 10, you've got number one, Novo Nordisk, number two, number two, Microsoft, number three, Meta, number four, Stryker, or number four, L'Oreal, number five, Stryker, number six, LVMH. Sorry, 1 second, got to click through here. Number six, LVMH. Number seven, IDEX Laboratories. They sell like diagnostics equipment, I believe, for veterinary clinics. Eight, Visa. Nine, Philip Morris. 10, Automatic Data Processing, also known as ADP. I'll probably just leave it there because we don't want to go through all of them. But a lot of them are pretty old companies. And actually, as you get into the 10s and 20s of his holdings, which are much smaller positions, they get older and older. Actually, you know, I'm looking at some of these businesses in the top 10 and they're fairly, I don't want to say new because Microsoft is whatever, 70 years old, yeah. Almost now.
40 years.
I thought Microsoft was built in the 70s. So what would that be? 50 some years. Was it late 60s?
Meg, let's see. Let's do a little Googling right now. April 4th, 1975, Albuquerque,
oh, that's wrong.
New Mexico. 50 years, I guess, almost exactly.
Okay. Meta's the youngest one here, I believe, unless I'm wrong about IDEX. Don't really know them that well. But a lot of these are pretty old companies. they, if you're looking at 13F, the 13F doesn't encapsulate all of their holdings because it's all US holdings, and there's some European ones in there. The biggest ones are Novo Nordisk, L'Oreal, and LVMH. Is there anything that you would have expected him to own that you didn't see in here?
Well, I think a lot of the people that own Visa also essentially just own MasterCard equal weighted. And maybe that comes back to the fact that they try to be very disciplined on valuation, and MasterCard has had very few times over the last few years or last decade where it's traded at a cheaper multiple, and Visa's had a couple where it's generally been a little bit cheaper. So maybe that's why, or maybe they have a differentiated view on the two companies. So I was a bit surprised to see that, because MasterCard is basically in their starter position. I believe it was a 0.1% allocation, so essentially a watch list. I was a bit surprised, I wasn't surprised to see LVMH. I think that makes a lot of sense for him. Traded at a reasonable price at a few times. They're able to buy trusting brands, good runway for reinvestment, great organic growth, you know, ROICs are fantastic, pricing power, blah, 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 high margins. But I was a little surprised to not see any other fashion and luxury in the portfolio. No Hermes, no Ferrari, no the other ones out there. What were your thoughts on that? And maybe the quick answer is Ferrari and Hermes to trade at such a high valuation.
Yeah, that could definitely be part of it. The other one is that it doesn't seem like, just looking at his portfolio, Nike being the exception, that he loves companies where it's built around a single brand, like you've got with Hermes. LVMH, obviously, it's a house of brands, tons of different ones, kind of diversifies the risk away from any sort of brand damage that comes over the years. Hermes and Ferrari are both, you know, one not one product, but one brand companies. You look at companies like Pepsi, even Philip Morris, they have a lot of different cigarettes within their portfolio. LVMH, trying to think of some of the other conglomerates here, McCormick, they have a ton of different brands. So it seems like he loves these house of brand style investments. Honestly, he owns a lot of stocks. He owns like these tiny tracker positions, like 40 companies. He owns MasterCard, but it's tiny.
Which, yeah, it's pretty much a watch list.
Yeah. So, I mean, it seems like he loves big tech, ironically, because that's the only reason he hasn't outperformed the NASDAQ 100. Why wouldn't Amazon fit in there? It checks a lot of the boxes for me in terms of their watch list.
Here's what's interesting. At the annual meeting, which I actually just watched this clip of it this morning, is he said they bought Amazon. No big deal, right when we were buying it. when it was getting cheap, and you know, that's nothing special. There was a ton of people buying it. We honestly were relying on some other high quality reports. I'd actually mention, go check out our interview with Ed Chang. Did a great report on it that turned out basically completely right. But that's besides the fact. They bought it, I think, when the valuation crept down, 2022, 2023. I forget the exact date. But then they ended up selling. And it was for a strange reason, because maybe he's unaware of how much Amazon hypes up their conference calls. Because he basically said that the new CEO, Jassy, was on the conference call hyping up how much they were going to invest in grocery delivery. And he was like, this sounds like a terrible idea. I don't think it can work. We're going to sell it because the return on investment is going to be terrible. And it was a bit of a strange reason to sell, because that's, you know, even if it's a huge investment, it's still a small part relatively of Amazon's business. But then he was like, well, they didn't end up doing that. And I was like, welcome to the technology companies, man, because they like hyping up stuff and a lot of times they don't follow through. So I think also, that's why they sold, and he was a little bit upset about that because, you know, they ended up being quite right about it.
Yeah, I mean, it is tech companies, especially these big conglomerates, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, less so Apple. They love to hype up these small parts of their business that are kind of green shoot opportunities where there could be something big, when in reality, the things that drive the returns for those companies over like 5 to 10 years are typically just their core business dominating and growing ever larger.
Yeah. And I think it's, they're not really, even though they're speaking to investors, I think they're not speaking to investors with those things. They're trying to use that as free marketing to get new engineers for their R&D department or whatever type of worker you might want, and basically get articles written about them in TechCrunch so they can get free marketing in that way. And then, you know, engineers read it. They're like, oh, they're working on all this cool stuff. I want to be a part of that. And yeah, we'll help you translate, Terry. These U.S. companies, they're a little different over here on the West Coast.
I don't mind the grocery investment, to be honest. Like,
yeah, Walmart's like margins, that. I think, yeah, Walmart translated or transitioned, made a huge transition in the 21st century to grocery, and it hasn't killed their business. Now, I have an anecdote here that I think was interesting in relation to his Philip Morris investment. I read some of his earlier letters, and they actually invested in Swedish Match in 2013, 2014, 2015. For reference.
Oh my gosh. You're kidding.
For reference, they bought, Philip Morris bought Swedish Match, but.
Oh, wait, 2013, 2014.
Yeah. So what's interesting about it is that they ended up selling Swedish Match because the company made some mistakes about the SNES product, and they were worried about, and maybe it was a little later, but they were worried about the huge growth in vaping and how they were exposed with the SNES products to vaping, which I think makes sense. And sure, their management team really never inspired that much confidence, even though they kind of did some things extremely well. And it's a high quality business with the chewing tobacco and SNES products, the lower risk stuff. And it was right before they came out with the nicotine pouches, which helped supercharge their growth. So I think it was interesting where he was like, man, we sold that, but then we're buying back Philip Morris here. Maybe they own both. And I'd be curious to hear what his thoughts were on that subsidiary today.
I would have loved.
I wonder if he has the same thoughts as John Hempton on how they kind of got lucky a little bit.
Yeah, that was maybe the biggest one. Well, it's certainly the biggest one that got away for us, but it surprises me that there weren't more activist investors willing to step in and stop that buyout from happening.
Right.
Especially, you know, if Fundsmith knows that business, let's say they followed it after they sold, I think it checks all the boxes that he would have liked. So why not step back in and do something about it? And maybe I'm just griping here because I had my
Maybe he's a gold mine
taken from me.
Yeah, maybe he's just Philip Morris shareholder. But I thought that was interesting. And with the Amazon thing, I think they are not afraid to accidentally cut a position and be over worried about something because they see, you know, so much opportunity anywhere else. There's plenty of companies out there where, okay, we may have sold Amazon for the wrong reasons, right? But there's a chance we were right. And like, as long as they feel the risk reward is higher in their existing portfolio, it's not the end of the world, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's move to our last question here. What stands out about Fundsmith, maybe Terry Smith and include him here as well. What stands out about Fundsmith today? Do you think the strategy is replicable throughout all market environments? And then this one's a more speculative question. Can the strategy outperform over the next two decades? You can go first.
Okay. And I ask these type of questions because I think a lot of, and look, these are fair criticisms people can put out there. I'm not saying like you're wrong to have these sort of questions, but when someone starts a high quality fund in 2010, I think there's a lot of people that just go, eh, that was good timing. You know, had they timed it well and they got lucky. And the way I look at it is I don't really think so, because if you look at their growth, and I'll get through some of the numbers here where, yeah, you might not expect the multiple to expand, you know, that much, but all right. Well, let me just go through the first question. What stands out about Fundsmith? I think they are one of the few investors that truly holds for the long term. You have Buffett, you have David Gardner, and kind of the other people in the Motley Fool tree. You have the Acri funds, you have Fundsmith here, and others that I'm clearly missing. There's more than four, which they actually do what their documents say. Unsurprisingly, they all seem to have done well over the long term, and they have quite low portfolio turnover. Is the strategy replicable through all market environments? I think so. Like, look, they could even say that they, like, they're not heavy exposure to software, AI, big, they're not even that exposed to big tech, Magnificent Seven, stuff like that. And they're investing in a lot of lower volatility stocks. They're typically at around a market multiple. They're supposedly, you know, obviously everyone has to do their own analysis, but high quality and higher growth. And they think they can outperform over the long haul. I mean, if you think that the businesses are of higher quality and they're trading at very close to the market multiple, which right now they're slightly above on a free cash flow yield, but they believe specifically their cash flow conversion was a little artificially low in 2023 and that'll reinvert. So it's like, you know what I mean? It's a little bit misleading from kind of their earnings multiple right now. And they're really disciplined on price. And they're not afraid to, you know, sell something that's at an egregious multiple. And they are only going to buy stuff if they think it's a reasonable valuation. I don't really see how that does, you know, that stops working. Yeah, as long as they can find stuff that becomes, like Meta in 2022, a high-quality business that gets its market, you know, price dislocated. Now,
what do you think about this? What do you think about this? In 2010, the average free cash flow yield of Fundsmith's portfolio was 7%. In 2023, the average free cash flow yield, weighted average free cash flow yield, was 3%.
It's essentially a double.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
they're paying higher multiples today than what they were paying in 2010.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure that tracks what the global one would probably be, or maybe not global, maybe S&P. I'm sure that's similar to that.
Yeah, that's true. It was kind of a good time to be starting a fund.
It's good timing, but they still outperformed.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
Okay, last one. Can this strategy outperform over the next two decades? And I think this is the big question I wanted to put in here, because a lot of people would say, like, okay, 2010 to 2024, yeah, you did great, but high quality is not going to work. You know, value factors back, blah, 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 blah. I still think it can. I mean, if you expect 16% annual returns, that might be a stretch because you probably still need multiple expansion. But I do think, you know, given that they trade close to a market multiple, and like I mentioned, they have these high quality businesses, I think if you believe in their strategy and believe in their acumen and their discipline, that you could probably expect a few percentage points above the market each year going forward on average. You know,
I agree.
Each year, I think one, you know, like, look, you're not going to get that much of a boost from multiple expansion. They got a big boost from multiple expansion, as almost every other investor did since 2010. Don't expect that going forward. I think they try to reiterate that as well.
Yeah. Something that really stood out to me is if you just showed me the holdings, you just showed me the whole portfolio, I would have guessed that it was pretty close to market performance, because they own a lot of the companies that are already in the major indices that make up a huge chunk of the major indices. And outside of a couple of the tech companies that have really outperformed, you would have gotten pretty standard returns. However, they beat the market constantly. And part of that, I think a big reason, was because they were opportunistic about the companies already in their portfolio. So they got better returns than actually just holding it. They, by buying when times were right for companies they owned, they were able to juice their returns a little bit each year. And I think if they can continue to do that, and when you really, really know a business, I think it becomes pretty easy to do that, where you followed it for a long time, you thought it was a good investment 5 years ago, and now you think it's a really home run investment because the stock's down because of something that
shouldn't really be weighing as heavily on the stock. So anyways, I just think they've done a really good job of that portfolio management side of things. And I suspect they can continue to do that. The only thing is, I know this is kind of funny because I just said they could probably outperform the market, but I just have a hard time believing that they're going to wildly outperform when they own companies that actually make up a giant chunk of the actual index itself.
Yeah, I think it comes back to what you just said, is the portfolio management, trusting that they'll change weightings and they'll be sensitive to price. But the track record's there, but I do agree where, you know, the valuations are stretched. Okay. Are you making basically the same bet as QQQ? Slightly different, of course. But, you know, philosophy-wise, maybe. But, I mean, the track record's been quite strong. And this is, you know, maybe the best investor in Britain, I'd say. Although I don't know every investor in Britain. Some people call him the British Warren Buffett, I think. But yeah.
Just because of the style.
Record's a little shorter, but he's got a few... He's a couple decades behind.
Question for you.
Okay.
Do you like this strategy? Buying really high quality, proven companies that have been around for a long time and just holding them? Or
basically saying Lindy effect, good price.
Or do you prefer trying to find hidden gems?
I like hidden gems more. I think it comes back to, well, he's running a large fund for people with different styles, and I'm someone in my 20s, doesn't have that much money, and
it's more fun, in my opinion.
Looking for smaller companies or maybe faster growing companies. And I think personally, I'm very comfortable with volatility. So, you know what I mean? So it's not something I'm
to the upside,
about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable when it goes up fast. Yeah.
But in all seriousness, I don't really get too scared when something falls. So I don't know. That's just not a bulletproof investor by any means, but that's just something I know that I'm not scared of. And so I'm not really scared of investing something that I could go, okay, it falls 50%. No big deal. All right. Anything else, Ryan, before we head out here?
Pretty much covers everything.
Okay. Well,
the guy. He does seem confident in himself. He seems to be a little less outspoken than he used to be, but I like his investing style.
For sure. I mean, yeah, great writer. Read some of his stuff. Annual meeting's quite entertaining. And, you know, he's a damn good investor. The results speak for themselves. All right. Housekeeping items. Subscribe to the newsletter. Links are in the show notes. Chit Chat Stocks over on Substack. Follow us on Twitter/X. Keep updated with the show. You can listen to these on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, wherever you prefer to listen to podcasts. And on the YouTube, yes, there is video, although it's essentially just a Zoom feed of Ryan and I. If you enjoy this show, give us an old 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. We'd greatly appreciate it. And if you want to essentially give back to these shows, since they're free, that is the best way to do it. You can think of it as a little donation if you enjoy Chit Chat Stocks. Now, let me hit the disclosure. We are not financial advisors. Anything we say on the show is not formal advice or recommendation. Ryan, I, or any podcast guest may hold securities discussed in this podcast, may have held them in the past, and may buy, sell, or hold them in the future. Thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next time.